Welcome to the Payments Journal Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Mack. And in a rapidly changing and evolving payments industry, data is becoming almost as important as the payment itself. With consumers' hunger to use innovative third-party apps, transferring banking and payment-related data has become a critical component to the payment value chain. So on this episode, we're going to be talking about data aggregation, and I'll be joined with Paul Diegelman, who is the VP of Digital Payments and Data Aggregation at Fiserv, and Sarah Grotta, who is the Director of the Debit and Alternative Products Advisory Service at Mercator Advisor Group. Now, during this episode, Paul and Sarah are going to help us to unpack some visual data that can be viewed on the companion article to this podcast on paymentjournal.com. And to begin today's episode, Sarah is going to be providing us with a market overview to help set the stage for this growing component to the payment industry. So without any further delay, let's start the show.
Thanks, Ryan. You know, data aggregation in the financial services world may not sound like a really exciting topic, but it's actually gaining in importance, I believe. And it's been in the news quite a lot recently, and so I think it really deserves our attention. And, you know, I was thinking about this past November as an example. There was a bit of a fervor when it was found out that PNC Bank is blocking the third-party data aggregator Plaid from getting access to PNC customers' account information for purposes of opening up Venmo accounts. Now, Venmo is using Plaid to do the work of connecting customers' checking accounts to the Venmo app for funding and cash outs on their P2P application. Now, I think we can appreciate PNC's concerns, and by the way, other banks are blocking Plaid as well. But, you know, banks are concerned because, you know, there's a bit of a competitive issue. I'm sure that banks would rather have their account customers use their own P2P solution. But secondly, you know, there's a real concern about handing over customer data to a third party that the financial institution doesn't know all that well, doesn't know if the customer has actually authorized the transfer of that data, and maybe really isn't sure about that third party's security. So I think it was is interesting that, you know, we had some of that activity going on, and then just a few months later after that headline news, Visa announced that it was purchasing Plaid for $5.3 billion. Now, all of a sudden, data aggregation is getting a lot more attention. So $5.3 billion, that's a lot of money. Why would Visa pay that kind of money for a fintech like that? And I think that, you know, what's happening is that even though open banking in the U.S. is not mandated, we're seeing it play out this way through a growing interest in the part of consumers and sometimes small businesses to connect their bank and credit union account information to a third-party app for a variety of services to help them to manage their finances and maybe even open up accounts. And it's the data aggregators that are sitting in the middle to make these connections possible. So, you know, data aggregators are not only needed for P2P apps like Venmo, but also for, you know, budgeting and savings and investing apps, private label debit cards like GasBuddy and Cumberland Farms, if you're familiar with those, digital mortgage origination, loan origination applications, and even some of the digital-only financial institutions. So I think buying Plaid gives Visa a jump start into what is becoming sort of the private sector approach to open banking in the U.S. And I also think that, you know, putting Visa's oversight on Plaid services will help to get, you know, more financial institutions comfortable with sharing their customers' financial data.
So Paul and Sarah, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode as we're taking a look at data aggregation here. Now, we have this wonderful chart provided to us that's taking a look at consumer interest in platforms to manage their finances. So Paul, I was hoping that you could help perhaps walk our audience through this chart and what it means.
Yeah, sure. Happy to. So as Sarah mentioned, consumers have widely embraced the notions that data aggregation supports. That ultimately provide varying levels of speed and convenience and opportunity to consumers. And Sarah mentioned a few of them. So what Fiserv's market research team did, and you see it in this chart, is we asked over 3,000 consumers three questions around their interest level in, if you look on the left, managing all of their finances from a single website or an app, And to do that, if you look in the middle, would they be interested in connecting their bank account data to such an app? And then on the right, with such information, would they be interested in reviewing all of their credit card statements, no matter the card issuer, in a single view that would help them track spending across all of their cards and budget categories? And what we found, and you see it in the chart, is that over one third of respondents were either extremely interested or very interested in doing these things. You can also see within here that their interest level really varied based on age. In some cases, Gen Z, as they're called, is 4 to 5 times more interested in sharing their financial information with third parties than, say, someone in the senior category would be. So these are the sorts of opportunities that consumers take advantage of today. And to do it, in many cases, data aggregation enables that process.
So, Paul, thank you for that overview there. And before we move on to our next question, I want to remind our audience that they'll be able to view this chart in the slider above or in the article below on paymentjournal.com. Now, Paul, if I could come back to you here. We love really talking about definitions on the Payment Journal podcast here. So I'd love to get a working definition on what is a data aggregator. And possibly, could you provide our audience with an example?
Yeah, certainly. So in the context of this podcast, Ryan, we're talking about consumer permissioned financial data aggregation. So let me give you an example, then I'll give you sort of a formal definition. The concept is often easier understood with some examples. So as an example, let's say a consumer applies for a mortgage, and as part of the qualification process, they need to provide 3 months of bank statements. That's a fairly typical requirement at the mortgage origination point. So today, many mortgage originators, instead of asking the consumer to bring paper bank statements or email in PDFs, they are now providing the ability for the borrower to input their bank's username and password for the bank account into the originator's loan system. And the originator then connects to a data aggregator, maybe Fiserv or Plaid or MX, those are some great examples. And the aggregator then pulls 3 months of statements from the consumer's bank account and provides the digital rendering of that statement directly into the originator's platform. So in this case, the consumer didn't have to go find any bank statements or scan them into PDFs or create them from their computer and email them in. In this case, the aggregator then provides the statements, and it's entirely possible that the mortgage process goes much faster for the consumer. So there's a dimension of speed, there's a dimension of convenience that data aggregation can provide in this case. And, you know, as we know, consumers value speed when it comes to their finances. So with that example, let me go to the formal definition. So I started out by calling it consumer permissioned financial data aggregation. So consumer permissioned means that the consumer has clearly consented to the process and has provided their credentials for their bank. And in return, that consumer has the expectation of security, privacy, transparency, in the use of their data, as well as getting some form of a benefit from it, whether it's speed or convenience or what have you. But the point in this half of the definition is that the consumer must provide their consent. The second part of the definition I used, I called it financial data aggregation. And that's the space where Fiserv operates, and it includes financial data that's pulled or aggregated from 18,000 sources, banks, credit unions, credit card platforms, mortgage platforms, investments, other things like that. So connecting all that together for the benefit of a mortgage origination platform or for a fintech app or for something that helps with budgeting or, as Sarah mentioned, Gas Buddy, for example, you know, if someone had to connect all that together to launch their app, it'd be very difficult. So aggregators have built this underlying set of pipes so that all these parties can connect together in a much faster process and deliver something to the consumer that the consumer finds of value.
Paul, so I know that you're playing a big role in data aggregation, and you talked a little bit about mortgage applications. Is that one of the big areas where you're seeing the most activity?
It's certainly a growth area. I wouldn't say it's the most, but it's absolutely a growth area. So anything related to credit, borrowing, lending is a high growth area. Certainly, some of let's call them the old-fashioned use cases of personal financial management and wealth advising, they continue to grow and continue to resonate. You mentioned, I go back to your Gas Buddy reference, there are so many use cases that I think 5 years ago no one had even contemplated for this. Things like financial wellness, the notion of how much are people spending on things, or how do you aggregate the data across all of your bank accounts to maybe offer a reward program or some sort of an incentive. So there's just so many use cases that continue to grow. And I think the opportunities have grown with them.
Interesting. And you also mentioned, sort of the permissioning aspect. So you're capturing, when a consumer says, yes, I am giving you permission to grab my data, you're providing sort of an audit trail, if you will, if that's ever necessary to go back and to check.
So the point at which the consumer has keyed in their username and password, so whether that's an origination platform or a fintech app or where, that is the point where the permissioning is kept. Now, mm-hmm. most aggregators like us, Plaid, MX, others, also provide widgets and APIs such that the point at which the consumer is keying in their information is often not visible to one of those apps. Instead, it's a widget or an API so that someone like Fiserv is actually maintaining those credentials. So the consent piece is managed by the app or the platform that the consumer has that relationship with. The tokens are managed by someone like Fiserv.
Excellent. No, and I thank you, Paul, there for clarifying those couple questions there. But now I'd like to go back to where we were talking about, adding value here. And you kind of brought up a couple use cases there. So I'd really like to kind of focus in on that. So I'd love to know for our audience, how does data add value to a business and consumers? And perhaps we could provide a little bit more of some of the detailed examples that you have.
Yeah, sure. So let's do the consumer, then we'll do the business. So from the consumer standpoint, financial data aggregation provides a number of opportunities. So we talked a little bit about speed and convenience already. I mean, I'm like most people, Ryan, I imagine you are too. Our days are filled with things we have to do, things we want to do, and some things we don't want to do. But we're all busy. Everybody's got a lot going on. So, I mean, here's another example. Online sports betting is a growth industry in the U.S. today. And just as Sarah used the reference around consumers funding their Venmo account, the very same use case exists with consumers who want to fund their online sports betting account or app. Exact same process. And if someone listening uses sports betting apps, there's a high likelihood that they have used a data aggregation process to verify their bank account and move money from their bank account into that sports betting app. Very high likelihood. So it's an example of speed and convenience that creates the advantage the consumer wants. They wanted to verify themselves to that app and they wanted to get money over to that app. Aggregation, as well as other digital money movement techniques, creates that opportunity for them. You had also asked a little bit about the advantages to businesses. So, obviously if a business wants to have customers and they need to use these techniques to grow that customer base, I mean, that's an obvious opportunity for them. But imagine you run a budgeting app, and to help all of your consumer customers, you need to connect your app to each of the sources of information that your consumers would need to bring in. It'd be very difficult to build out the links to tens of thousands of endpoints and sources. So to a business that wants to help consumers and do it in a way where aggregated data is necessary, data aggregators have already built the pipes, the infrastructure, the plumbing to get from one app all the way out to tens of thousands of other sources so that the data can move across and then be used within the app for the advantage of the business and for the customer.
No, thank you for that there. Now, for the next question that I've got here, Paul. So if we're going to talk about data, we need to talk about privacy. And I know we talked a little bit about this, but let's really drive this home, because I think it is a very thing that's very top of mind with every single consumer business, anything to do with any type of financial services. Privacy, kind of overlays all of that there. So what are some of the hallmarks of a strong or safe aggregator?
So, we've talked a little bit about consent and a little bit about privacy, and you're absolutely going the right direction on this, Ryan. When consumers want to connect their bank transactions to other apps, they do it for a specific purpose. They absolutely expect that the consent they are providing is for that purpose and not for other purposes. And they have an expectation of privacy around who sees the transactions, how safe will these transactions be, and that sort of thing. And candidly, the banks or the credit card platforms or the folks on the other end of the transaction, they have the very same expectations. So if we focus on security for a minute, even though the consumer provided their username and password in an app or a platform of their choosing, in most cases, those apps and platforms don't have those credentials. You know, I mentioned widgets and APIs. You know, our model is similar to others like Plaid and MX, where it is the aggregator that is holding those things. It's not that a user's password for their bank is sitting in thousands of apps. It's often sitting in a much smaller universe of providers. And, you know, folks like Fiserv are well known for the data security we provide to the rest of the financial system. So it's not a big leap to believe we could do it here. So that's an important piece that consumers do rely on. And candidly, like I said, the bank should as well.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important there. You know, the visual that I always kind of get is that the data aggregator kind of almost plays like the bouncer to a club, right? Like, you're not going to get in unless you're on the list here. So it's not a, hey, I'm putting in my direct credentials to my bank information. It's, hey, I'm allowing you to kind of reach out and say, hey, on my behalf, you can ask for this type of data and have the bank pass that along to you, but I have to say that it's okay. And they're not going to tell you exactly like, oh, well, here's how you get into that person's account and you go get the information itself. You kind of have to have that additional layer of security there that just says, yeah, you can get in, but you can only see this part, or you can only sit at this portion of the bar or whatever, maybe just the little bit of the visual that I get from there. But moving on to another topic here, faster payments. So obviously a huge topic in 2019 and obviously carrying over into the year 2020. So the question I have is, can data aggregation enable faster payments?
So it certainly can. It enables payments today, and some part of the answer about faster payments depends on kind of the quote, faster than what. Let me give you an example. If you need to pay your child's school lunch bill on the school's website, and they only take ACH payments, that's fairly common for school lunch payments. Finding your checkbook, getting your routing and DDA, then keying all that in takes some amount of time, but it's often faster if what you'll put in instead is the username and password to your bank that you probably remember anyway. Like, it's often not much different than the way you remember your PayPal login as opposed to remembering your credit card or your debit card number. Very similar notion. So in this case, if the website that runs payments for your school, your child's school lunch, has an aggregation component, you in fact can probably pay that monthly bill faster than without it. And I think another great example is the one Sarah has already mentioned about, you know, P2P payments. You know, many consumers are using Zelle and PayPal and Venmo today to make person-to-person payments. And the notion of connecting a bank account to an app that makes payments is often allows for payments that are far faster than, you know, writing a check or fishing cash out of your pocket or going to the ATM. So, I mean, I think those are two examples of how data aggregation does today make payments faster than the legacy methods that were in use before this.
I'm going to pile on here just a little bit. You know, I really do think that these aggregation services may be the mechanism that really launches real-time payments in a point of sale environment. And I think nothing happens overnight, but I think this will be certainly an area that we'll watch to see if, you know, some of these new apps, some of these new payment devices in connection with aggregation services really start to develop in a new point of sale payment capability that's sort of outside of the current networks that we're using today. I think it's going to be a fascinating area to watch.
So, you know, to that point, Sarah, I can confirm that point of sale payments enabled by data aggregation is in fact a growth area. And the sprouts of grass have started to come up, and it is in fact an opportunity that a number of folks in the industry, Fiserv included, are carefully focused on.
No, certainly very interesting, something that we'll certainly have to keep a close eye on. So now to close out our conversation, I'd love to get from your perspective, Paul, you know, what is next for data aggregation?
So there's a couple of important themes underway in the market, and we've begun touching on them in some way. The first has to do with the legacy method of aggregation, which uses a form of screen scraping or credential-based harvesting versus newer forms of direct connection for the aggregator to get the data. And the second really is what I think is a super important theme referred to more and more as open banking. And Sarah made that reference prior. So let me hit them both in that order. You know, the notion of screen scraping or harvesting relies on an aggregator writing scripts that automate the same process a consumer would use to log into their bank, and then the data that's been requested gets pulled. And that can create a burden on the bank on the other end. And honestly, when I say it can, I should actually say it does. We know this because Fiserv runs thousands of bank cores and online banking applications. So when screen scraping occurs, we actually see the way it impacts the infrastructure at the bank, because in many cases, that infrastructure is in our data center. And so one of the things that's been underway for a while is for aggregators to move away from that notion and to move to either some form of a direct connection or what has more recently been referred to as OAuth, which is a token-based model that also provides a dimension of privacy and consent as well. So that is very much underway, and that will not go away. You'll hear more and more talk about open banking, more and more talk about OAuth, as folks look to move away from this traditional screen scraping. Now, that said, there are thousands of banks in the U.S. I think between banks and credit unions, there's well over 11,000. Some number of them are not going to have the technical expertise and the infrastructure to move away from harvesting and scraping. So that concept is going to exist for the smaller banks and credit unions for some time, but the larger and mid-sized banks are absolutely moving in a direction that really would have screen scraping and harvesting not in the process, certainly not to the degree it was. So the other piece here, and this is justified, I'd add, is around this notion of open banking. We are supportive of open banking and OAuth. We became a board member of the Financial Data Exchange. That's you'll hear it referred to often as FDX. It's an industry organization that brings together FIs, data aggregators, other interested parties who want to develop standards around the process of account aggregation with the goal of balancing the consumer's desire to utilize and share their data for some purpose in concert with their bank's prioritization around data security and use cases. And so that often is what people refer to as open banking, and that is maturing in the U.S. market at an advancing rate, and it's something that we believe benefits all parties.
No, I certainly agree with you there, and I certainly do feel the same sentiment in terms of just, you know, financial institutions moving more towards that API model and away from the screen scraping. Just because having done screen scraping, you just realize the inefficiencies that are there, and then also the integrity of the data. And then if things change on the particular screen that you're scraping for, all of a sudden break or change, you have to go in and update and change and modify your code to be able to capture all of the data that you need. And in reality, it's a very just inefficient process. So certainly glad to see that kind of the standardization of APIs is moving forward. But Paul, Sarah, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about Fiserv and data aggregation. And I hope to have you both back on the podcast real soon.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks, Ryan.